Welcome today to our interview series with Outstanding Professionals. I'm Stephen Ibaraki, and I'm conducting an exclusive interview with Anand Sanwal. Anand is a top innovator, CEO, and co-founder of CB Insights. Anand is sharing deep entrepreneur lessons and much more. Anand is very passionate about predictive intelligence into the health of private companies, their investors, and emerging industries they compete in. So Anand, an incredible background, and thank you for sharing your deep experiences with our audience.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Stephen. I appreciate you making the time.
Now, Anna, can you describe your journey from, let's say, the age of 4 to your 20s and some of the milestones and valuable lessons that continue to shape your vision, goals, and execution style?
Yeah, sure thing. You know, I grew up in a household where my father was an entrepreneur. Actually, he worked for a big company for a long time and kind of got fed up and decided to start his own thing. So he wasn't always an entrepreneur. But I think that was probably the most kind of influential thing in my journey, if you can call it that. Just seeing him take that risk, seeing the family kind of go from sort of, relative comfort of having a corporate job to essentially sort of no income coming in. So the kind of the sacrifice and the grind that he went through is probably the thing that I kind of remember the most. I also, kind of remember the sacrifice that was required of my mom to kind of help support that. And so kind of how much, she was raising me and my sisters while my dad was kind of pursuing the stream of his, and which sort of required him being pretty consumed. So I think that was, probably the most formative thing in my background and sort of, from an entrepreneur perspective. I went to the University of Pennsylvania and so met, it's a great school, but I think beyond that I met some really great folks there, and I think some people who remain my closest friends who kind of sort of helped me or forced me to raise my game. And so I think, being around very smart people who are doing really impactful things today has sort of been a great motivator and sort of inspiring. I think those are kind of the big things, sort of seeing my family get into the entrepreneurship and then kind of going to university and being surrounded with folks that I think helped sort of me see the world a bit broader than sort of suburban New Jersey where I grew up.
So just for the benefit of the audience, I just mentioned that we're doing this interview and it's in an open space, which is sort of the style today. So some of the background noise is the different staff communicating and so on. So just to give the audience a bit of a heads up. And I can see how that journey that you went through your early years can help you and shape your vision for the entrepreneurial lifestyle, which is can have sort of ups and downs and a lot of churn and things like that. Now, Anand, you managed the $50 million Chairman and Innovation Fund, American Express. What are some of the lessons you can share from that time?
Yeah, I mean, I think, the biggest lesson was sort of became the root of CB Insights was, we were interested in the private markets, and it was really hard to get that information. And so kind of being on the side of the customer for this data kind of and seeing the pain point, I think that was sort of the seed for what became CB Insights. So I think that was one of the big pain points. From a corporate perspective, being in a really large organization like American Express, which is extremely well run, what became apparent was the challenge of innovating within a large company. So I think big companies are very good at kind of scaling and exploiting advantages they have. They're not always as good in exploration, right? And so I think that was one of the challenges that we had. I think one of the other big learnings, and when we talk to clients today, is that you can't innovate kind of using consensus, right? So you can't try some bold new thing and try to get everybody on board. That's sort of, you're just going to end up building this watered down kind of thing that's not very good. So I think, I learned a lot about sort of what makes big organizations work, what doesn't work, and then how would you, if I had to do it again, kind of how would I attack these problems. But I'd say the biggest learning from kind of the Chairman's Innovation Fund, besides getting access to some really interesting technologies and companies and things that were happening at the cutting edge of financial services, was this germ of an idea that sort of eventually became CB Insights, which is that the private markets, which are massive, are incredibly opaque, and there's an opportunity to fix that.
I can see how the having this position to managing this innovation fund can give you such a great foundation leading into CB Insights. Now, prior to CB Insights, you had some experience with Cosmo.com. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, so Cosmo was a startup in the first dot-com boom, so kind of the 99-2001 time frame. It was sort of a predecessor to a lot of companies out there today that are doing things that are similar. So it was a online delivery company. So you could order a video, if you remember VHS, and Ben & Jerry's, and it would be delivered to your door in 30 minutes or less. Highly convenient, something that actually, living in New York City, something that people here kind of value quite a bit is that convenience. And so we raised a ton of money. I think it was something like $260 million. I was launching the fulfillment centers, the warehouses, in New York and Atlanta, and then eventually they sent me to Europe to launch Cosmo Europe. Phenomenal run, worked probably the hardest I'd ever worked before CB Insights. Met really good people, was doing things that I'd never thought. I wasn't sort of trained in launching fulfillment centers, but, managed to do it. So learned a lot. I think, learned a lot about business fundamentals too, which was kind of a very simple one, but was that you can't buy something for $2 and sell it for $1 and hope that eventually things will work out. And so kind of learned the hard way that there's certain economic rules that you cannot defy. And so ultimately, I think Cosmo tried to defy them for longer than they had runway for, and so the company ended up failing, and that was when I moved to the kind of the venture and M&A group at American Express.
And there are so many lessons that you can learn from that experience. And I notice even in CB Insights, you'll sometimes do this sort of analysis of, I guess now the current list is over 150 companies who've launched and then had some kind of difficulty or challenge, and you've shared those insights with the broader marketplace. And I know that some of my colleagues have looked at some of those lessons and they find them so valuable. So that would be a really pivotal point in your life being at Cosmo, and thank you for sharing some of that background. What prompted you then to create CB Insights?
Yeah, there's a few things. I mean, like I mentioned before, saw this idea when managing the Innovation Fund that we were making these very big strategic decisions for the company about where we should, what markets we should think about or what areas we should innovate in or potentially even where we should invest. And we were doing it with really incomplete information. So, part of it was we saw this market need, and kind of it's not unlike probably many founder stories, which is, saw a pain point and thought we could build a better mousetrap. So that was part of it. Second part was really, always wanted to do my own thing, and corporate America is can get very comfortable, and I felt like I was getting a little comfortable and hence complacent. And I knew that if I never left to try my own thing, I would regret it, 10, 15 years down the road and kind of say, hey, I should have taken my shot. And I figured, I'm always employable. So if things don't work out, I'll go back. I don't think I probably am no longer employable, but back then I thought I was. And so, combination of idea with sort of this desire to start something led me to leave relatively suddenly, and then a few folks on my team joined me subsequently after leaving, and we became sort of the founding team of CBI.
Well, it's really fascinating. CBI, I know amongst some of the colleagues that I talk to, I mean, we find it so valuable, and a lot of the analysis that you provide, even freely, to the public, mm-hmm. and of course people should register to get the deeper insights, but just a great platform. And I can see how your past learnings have helped shape that as well. So where do you see CB Insights in 5 years and the predictive insights that you can provide for startups and investors and established companies and governments, academia, media?
Yeah, I mean, I think what your question's a good one in that it sort of highlights the diversity of potential customers that we have. You know, where we're really focused today is on the corporate segment. So, you know, we think, and when we look at our clients, they are making these really important strategic decisions about which markets they should enter, what products they should build, who they should acquire, you know, what are their competitors up to, and they do it with very little data. So we kind of euphemistically call it, you know, they do it often with the help of the pundit industrial complex. So there's this group of consultants and analysts and advisors, these sort of talking heads that they're using. And so we think with machine learning and data, we can help them make better decisions. And so to some degree, you can think of us like, you know, an algorithmic McKinsey. You know, so over the next 5 years, I think it's really kind of realizing that vision and sort of helping our clients with generally, you know, sort of the global 5,000 make these very important strategic decisions with data and not sort of the traditional sort of gut instinct and Google searches and guys with MBAs that they're relying on today.
I know that you were able to bootstrap your operation, and I think you recently closed a round, right?
Yeah, that's right. We bootstrapped to 65 people and, you know, millions in revenue, and then kind of decided we could use some more fuel in the tank to really scale things up. So we raised $10 million in November of 2015.
Well, congratulations, and I think it's well-deserved. Again, all the colleagues I talked to, myself, we just love what you put out. We also love your style, by the way, your newsletter.
just so. Thanks.
I always laugh.
Thanks. Yeah. That's evolved over time. I think when we started, you know, we thought, hey, we're going to be targeting corporations and VCs. You know, we need to be very buttoned up and talk to them and using jargon and sort of corporate talk. And we started experimenting with just talking to them like human beings and, you know, occasionally a little snarkiness and some humor and kind of pop culture references. And, yeah, it seems to have worked. I mean, our newsletter is growing by 1,200 people a week right now. So it's good data, really smart analyst team that puts together really good research coupled with, I think, hopefully a approachable voice has been good for us.
You just did an amazing job. So again, congratulations. Now, in order, what do you see as the top emerging industries, and then why?
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of really interesting things going on in technology broadly. You know, I'd say one of the hottest areas right now is sort of the artificial intelligence, sort of deep learning area. You know, it's sort of the stuff of science fiction that folks have talked about for a long time, but at least there's a sentiment now that technology's evolved to the point that some of these things can actually become a reality. And so I think that's one big area that we're seeing a lot of advances in. You know, digital health continues to be a really hot space. It's a little bit nebulous in that, you know, digital health covers a lot. It's everything from sort of, you know, healthcare, IT, all the way through to wearable technology. But, you know, under that very large umbrella, there's a lot of very interesting things happening. You know, there's wearable devices now to help patients help them manage their diabetes better. And so I think there's going to be some really impactful things that come out of that. Other big areas are in what we call sort of frontier tech. So things like augmented reality, virtual reality, and drones, for instance. So, you know, drones, I think there's a lot of sort of consumer interest in them, but I think some of the areas that, some of the applications that we find really compelling are drones as applied to industry. So if you're an insurance company and you need to assess damage, instead of sending people potentially into risky or dangerous areas, can you use a drone if you're on an oil rig and something breaks, instead of having somebody climb up or climb down into some you know, dangerous place that's windy and high and slippery, can you use a drone to do things like that? So I think that's another kind of really big, promising area. You know, kind of the other one that's sort of related is the area of robotics. You know, you can see folks like Google doing really kind of game-changing things there. And then I'd say, you know, fifth area that there's still a lot of room in, you know, there's a lot of hype as well, but I think fundamentally when it happens, it'll be transformational, is the area of autonomous vehicles. You know, and so again, I think there's the applications of autonomous vehicles and the impact it would have on our lives as consumers. But I think what's interesting about autonomous vehicles is all the broader impacts it has. So what does it mean for the insurance industry when people aren't getting in accidents? What does it mean for law enforcement when, you know, governments who rely on sort of speeding tickets and things don't have access to that revenue base? So, you know, I think it's much further out, but I do think it's inevitable. And so there's these implications on all these other spaces and industries that are really interesting from an advance like autonomous vehicles.
You know, those are some great insights you provided. Now, let's look at the flip side of that in order. What do you see as some of the top declining industries and why?
So I don't know if there's, you know, I'm hesitant to say that these industries are declining. So, you know, we tend to look at the data, obviously. And so when we look at where the money is flowing, you know, what we see is kind of shifts in and out of industries. So I'd say some of the industries that aren't, maybe where sentiment is a little bit more mixed to negative, you know, one of them, you know, there's e-commerce is an area. And so e-commerce, again, broadly, but so like within e-commerce, there's areas like subscription commerce and flash sales that I think, you know, again, where sentiment 4 years ago was extremely hot, but the exits haven't sort of been borne out. And so investors, you know, kind of get hot and bothered about markets when it seems like they're going to be big, and when they prove to not be, they also exit relatively quickly. Ed tech is another big area where I think there's always a lot of chatter about the massive opportunity within education. The challenge has been that there haven't really been substantial exits in that space. I think with the exception of LinkedIn's purchase of lynda.com, there really haven't been sort of those mega, you know, the proverbial unicorn exits. You know, those are two. Cybersecurity, which may be a little bit surprising, it's a really big area, but the challenge right now, I think, is that it's basically overfunded. And so as a result, I'm not sure there's a whole lot of opportunity. There's going to be quite a shakeout there. So those are kind of, I'd say, three of the areas that we're tracking to see if, you know, if sentiment sort of shifts back up in positive, or if it continues to decline, and with that decline in sentiment comes a decline in investment dollars eventually.
You know, one of the things, because I deal with a lot of CEOs and, 15,000 CIOs and CTOs, they're always asking about, you know, what are some of the outlier innovations? Those are, you know, where we're kind of just initially seeing, but could be really disruptive in, let's say, 15 years' time or 20 years' time, and maybe we're just seeing the beginning of it right now and 5 years. Do you know of any that sort of have been crossing your radar screen?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a few of the ones that I mentioned earlier. So I think, you know, this idea of artificial intelligence applied to different industries is going to be incredibly disruptive. It's, again, probably a little bit of a ways out. You know, the things like augmented reality or virtual reality and how that gets used in everything from, you know, training scenarios to entertainment, you know, to travel potentially. You know, again, like these are technology platforms that can reinvent how people interact with and consume kind of media and how they and entire industries. So I think those are big ones. You know, drones is another big one in terms of how many diverse applications it has. So yeah, those are some of the ones that are interesting to us because, again, the horizon for them is still looking out quite a while. There's some short-term applications, but as the technology gets better, the units get smaller, the capabilities get more robust, there's going to be a lot of interesting things happening.
you know, it, you sort of kind of triggered a thought. You know, you hear all this research on CRISPR-Cas9, this gene editing technique, which is really cheap, and you're now seeing some experimentation or some capabilities where they're doing it at the embryo stage as well. I guess China initially, and then I guess in the UK and also in the US coming up. What are your feelings about this? This, you know, really cheap tool to kind of do all of this gene editing.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, and I'd be remiss if I said I was an expert in this area, but I think this is something you see across various sort of technologies, right? It starts off with kind of this fringe use case. It's extremely expensive, and then over time, as people put resources and their brain power behind it, and technology catches up, the cost goes down while the capabilities increase, right? So this is not, you know, CRISPR is sort of the latest example, but, you know, if you look at, you know, everything from the microprocessor to cell phones, right, they all kind of started off like this. Like, I remember when I was a kid, and, like, one of my dad's friends, who's a sales guy, had a cell phone, and it was this huge brick, and it was, like, plugged in his car, and, like, you know, that was amazing back then. And now, you know, we don't think twice about, you know, having this much more powerful computer in our pocket all day long. So I think, you know, it's kind of the way technology develops, right? And so when we're talking to our corporate customers, I think that's often one of the biggest challenges. If you're the CIO of a large organization or marketing or any of, you know, those functions, is that it's really easy to dismiss these things today because they seem like fringe cases, or they seem like toys, or they seem like things that, you know, only sort of the early adopters tend to be into. But these are the same things that eventually will go mainstream, and that's when they become problematic for your core businesses. So,
now, earlier we talked about, you know, some of the emerging industries and so on, mm-hmm. and we talked about some of the declining ones and some of the outliers. Let's focus on fintech, because I know you've done some sort of deeper analysis in this area. What do you think will dominate beyond 5 years or 15 years?
Yeah, so I mean, I think there's a bunch of really interesting models that have emerged, and fintech is pretty broad again. So I think there's, you know, on the wealth management side, right, so there's a whole bunch of initiatives, you know, the proverbial robo-advisors, you know, Charles Schwab has sort of replicated that with some success. So I think this idea of sort of programmatic investing for the consumer to lower fees is one that's going to take hold for a long time. On the lending side, you have all these marketplace lenders. So again, this idea of connecting people with capital to those that need it across a platform versus, you know, the traditional method of I need a loan, I'm going to go to the bank. You know, there's going to be some casualties, of course, in these spaces, as there are with any sort of group of startups, but there's going to be a lot of interesting companies that come out of that world. Payments, big area where there's, I think, a lot of room for disruption. I hate to use that word because it's so overused, but I think there's going to be lots of opportunities there. You know, as my alma mater being American Express, I'm curious to see who kind of evolves and who sort of loses their hold on the market. And then the other one, big one, is insurance, right? So massive industry with billions or trillions of dollars kind of floating around, and really hasn't been touched by technology in a big way. So I think in terms of looking at things like P2P insurance or person-to-person insurance, I think there's going to be some interesting things that come out of there. You know, on the risk management side, the idea of big data and predictive analytics to help people use, to help insurance companies make better decisions about underwriting, using non-traditional data. So can you connect an Internet of Things device to a water heater and use that data to make better, you know, long-term underwriting decisions? So I think there's a lot of interesting connections in insurance. It's this massive industry that has been sort of spared technology advancement in a big way. But I think investors and companies are waking up to the opportunity there. So there's going to be a lot happening in that vertical as well.
You know, you've already touched upon this, and that's AI, artificial intelligence, deep learning, and machine learning, I guess all being related to each other, and that machine learning is is related to AI, and so is deep learning being a subset of machine learning. What do you think will dominate in the future in this whole area of artificial intelligence?
You know, and again, it's hard to know all of the applications in the future, right? I think right now what we're looking at is, there's people who are sort of trying to build, I think, horizontal kind of, platforms and technologies that are going to enable AI. And so I think those enabling technologies are going to be really important. And then there's these more kind of vertically or functionally specific AI tools. So there's, companies that are trying to be your personal assistant, right? Or there's companies that are going to try to help you, what Facebook and other folks are doing with sort of, ask a question and we'll get you an answer. So I think there's going to be then these sort of very specific use cases. And over time, those use cases will get more sophisticated as the technology improves, right? So, I imagine, and I've heard, in talking to folks, people in financial services are really interested in, how can they use AI just to help their clients. So if you're a wealth management client and you want answers to some quick questions, do you need to talk to an advisor, right? Can we intelligently, and I'm not talking about the horrible phone prompts and, that hell of a customer experience that we currently go through, but, can we use AI to help kind of service customers and get them answers to important questions without the requirement for advisors, and advisors then get moved to higher value tasks? So, but I think when you're doing something that involves people's money, the bar is obviously much higher than order me a pizza. And so it's going to take a little while before we get there, but these are the things that I think progressive organizations, big sort of incumbent organizations, are starting to pay attention to now, even though it might still be early days there.
Yeah, I guess you're also seeing long-term use of machine learning in things like predicting stock market trends and so on. So I guess it sort of underlies everything. Now, can you profile investment trends from 2015 and forecast into the next 2 years?
Yeah, so 2015 was a gargantuan year for funding into startup companies. It was the most since 2000. So, I think that, and as soon as we say that, I think that sort of sets off alarm bells for lots of folks that, hey, we must be in a bubble. It was a big year. Asia and North America kind of led the way. Europe was kind of a laggard, which it sort of has been consistently. Lots of money flowing in at the early stages and then really big money at the late stages. This has been buoyed by not just VC investors, but a whole sort of assorted cast of characters, from hedge funds to mutual funds to sovereign wealth funds getting involved. The first three quarters of the year were kind of really up. Q4 was where we saw sort of sentiment really dip, and we honestly didn't expect the dip in funding to happen so quickly. I think when we forecasted it, we thought it'd be Q1 of this year, but Q4 saw a pretty significant drop in both deal and funding levels, and I think that was expected. Again, happened a bit early, but it was driven by a few things. We had the public market starting to kind of come down. We had some pretty big kind of well-known sort of unicorn, the private companies worth over $1 billion that had some missteps. And then you just had this issue of private companies' valuations were becoming a little bit detached from reality and their underlying performance. So we saw this pullback that happened. So that happened in Q4. I think there's... we've never called the bubble. We still don't think we're in a bubble. We're looking at probably a healthy correction that we're undergoing right now, and I think that's going to persist for a while. That said, in the first 2 months of this year, there have been 8 new unicorns that have joined the club. And so you can still get that $1 billion valuation. So, people are still making bets, and maybe you're doing them at a little bit slower of a rate. The bar for these high valuations is going up. If you're an early stage company, I think is probably where you're going to be more challenged. If you're an early stage company that's growing like gangbusters, you're not going to have a problem. It's the ones that maybe are a little bit more kind of in the middle of the pack, who a year ago would have gotten funding because the environment was so robust, they're going to have some challenges in this current environment. And so I think we're going to see more of those companies fail or get, you know, kind of acquired for talent or just, you know, shut down just because there's less money out there.
I know that one of the things that you've been providing through your newsletter is just sort of tracking the these companies, startups with a billion-plus valuation. And you talked about some of the trends already, but can you get into more detail about them?
Yeah, I mean, you know, this has become the sort of list of unicorns that we have. You know, it's become oddly sort of a badge of honor for companies. So we have 153 unicorns today worth, I think it's $535 billion. That's, you know, pretty significant value ascribed to these companies, all paper valuations, so these aren't realized valuations, of course. You know, I think what we're seeing amongst these is, what's interesting is it's pretty broad-based, right? So we have enterprise companies, we have consumer companies, we have fintech companies. So it's, you know, kind of across sectors. It's not just one sector that's hot. It's, you know, if you believe this mantra of software eating the world, you know, it really is, you know, companies that are covering and trying to solve a pretty diverse array of problems. You also see diversity in terms of geography. So obviously Silicon Valley, New York, Massachusetts are well represented, but you see companies in many companies out of Asia, some companies out of Europe, even Canada as well. So there's a lot happening kind of broadly. So this is not just a U.S. phenomena. It's something that now has sort of transcended just Silicon Valley. Obviously, the Valley remains the epicenter for this type of innovation, but there is a lot happening globally as well.
But then you see in the news, you know, some of the write-downs that I guess institutional investors or maybe hedge funds are doing in these startups. What's your take on that?
Yeah, I mean, it's been interesting. You know, some of the mutual funds like Fidelity and T. Rowe have to mark to market these investments pretty regularly as part of their prospectuses. So it's kind of an interesting thing in that the private markets typically don't have that level of transparency. You know, I think it's, you know, the thing I don't know is on what basis they are making these markdowns. So, you know, if it's, and so it's hard for me to say how valuable they are. You know, if it's based on the fact that they have real financials and performance data for some of these companies and they're marking it down based on that, I think that's really interesting and very compelling information. If it's, you know, the general market has come down and so we're going to haircut everybody by a certain amount and it's a little bit more hand-wavy, you know, I'm not sure how meaningful those changes are month to month. But I think over time, you know, they're directionally probably quite interesting and quite useful. So companies like Dropbox, for instance, have been pummeled by these investors. And, you know, I think that makes, on the surface, seems to make a lot of sense without seeing their P&L. But looking at the valuation of their closest comparable Box in the public markets, you know, it's pretty clear that Dropbox's valuation had gotten, you know, again, sort of detached from reality. And so so I think some of the markdowns will make sense, but, you know, looking at them on a month-to-month basis, it's hard to know how valuable they are until we know kind of what the basis is for them making those markdowns.
You know, you have these investors out there, and you have startups, and a number of criteria go into whether they're going to do the investments. Where do you see machine learning in all of this, this ability to fund startups?
Machine learning as a driver of funding startups?
Yeah, or perhaps a tool. You know, Telefonica and Big ML, for example, I saw a news release where they're saying, you know what, we're going to try using machine learning to act as a filter of who we're going to fund and by how much, or at least that's my take on it. Where do you see that part of it?
Yeah, I mean, we're pretty, I mean, we use machine learning a lot at CB Insight. So, you know, we're obviously bullish on this as a kind of differentiator and as something that provides an advantage. you know, my honest reaction when I hear about most of the things machine learning applied to startups and venture capital is that, to be very frank, most of it is vapor. You know, I haven't seen, you know, anybody kind of really do it super thoughtfully. I think it's good for PR. If you're raising a fund and you want to look like you have a different approach, you know, you talk about your sourcing and how you use machine learning and, you know, all this sort of fancy stuff, and it makes you look good and maybe differentiates you with LPs who might invest in your fund. But when I hear funds talking about it, I haven't really seen anybody do it well. I think there's an inherent challenge. You know, we have 75 people who are working on this every day, all day. And, you know, if you're a fund, you know, this is back office, right? Like, this is not front of the office work. You know, I hope somebody's proves me wrong, but I've seen a lot of experiments in this area by funds, but nothing that I've seen that, like, is really all that impressive besides good marketing.
And you sit at the top of really this predictive intelligence and in this amazing ability that you brought to bear in this marketplace because of your great background and also what you started with CB Insights. But taking all into account, you know, what things continue to excite you?
Yeah, I mean, I was just sending an email to the team. You know, like as the company scaled personally, last year, I'd say 2015, I was spending my time away from product a little bit because we were trying to grow the rest of the organization and kind of get things nailed down. You know, when I look at our product pipeline, and, you know, now we have a product management team, so I'm a little bit more, I'm back kind of working with the product team more regularly. Like, we have really some amazing things that we're working on. So, you know, I'm super excited about just what we have going on here. You know, I love, more generally, like, part of the reason I love working at and being part of CB Insights is I love the content of what we do. So, you know, the fact that you and I are getting to have a conversation about drones and, you know, augmented reality and AI, you know, it's really fascinating stuff to me. So, So, you know, I that's kind of the other thing that kind of continues to excite me is, you know, I know there's a lot of chatter about a bubble, and there's every time some banal app gets funded, people kind of say, you know, hey, people aren't working on hard problems. But the reality is, like, for every one of those, there's also somebody who's trying to do something that's pretty impactful. And so I'm excited that we get to be at the forefront of tracking that and hopefully advising people using our data on how they can do it better as well. So those are kind of the things that, you know, I'm excited about. You know, as an organization grows, I'm excited to see who steps up and becomes a leader within the organization. So there's a lot of things kind of just culturally at CB Insights that I'm excited, maybe a bit anxious to see how they evolve.
And then we're going to mine your expertise and your experience as this, I would say, world figure now, with all the work you're doing and your sort of amazing background. So I'm going to ask a series of questions sort of mining that experience. For example, what makes an entrepreneur?
I'm not sure there's any one thing. I mean, I guess at the core, it's somebody who's just willing to take the leap and try something, you know, because if you don't do that, you can't do any of the rest. So I think, you know, somebody who's got enough confidence and enough innate sort of desire to want to go try something and maybe leave, you know, the safety net of employment or of college or wherever they might be to try something out, I think that's probably the core requirement of an entrepreneur.
And then what do you look for when highlighting investments?
And highlighting investments. So you're referring to sort of our research blog and things that we put out?
Yes, that's right.
Yeah. I mean, you know, I think we're trying to help people understand where the world is going. So we're trying, I think it's less almost about the investment and more about the underlying trend, right? So, you know, we published something on AI and we did a whole report on frontier tech. You know, there's these areas that are really opaque that the world is sort of trying to understand a bit more. And so I think if we can help shine a light on them, that's sort of part of our job using data. And then within that, we try to find interesting companies that, and we'll sometimes use investors as our proxy for determining who's interesting. So, you know, when we see a really well-known investor who's put a lot of capital into a company, you know, that's often a great indication that, hey, there might be something interesting there, and then that gives us a reason to dig into it. But, you know, I'd say we start with trying to understand the spaces that we think are interesting, and then the companies sort of come out of that as a consequence.
And again, because of your experiences and dealing with all sorts of companies, and you're also a great executive, what makes a great executive?
I mean, I'm still figuring it out, to be really honest, right? I think there's some things that I do well, and there's some things that I could do better. I think the thing that I'm starting to realize is that sort of resource allocation is probably like the number one skill that I need to have. And so that's, you know, I think a lot of people, when they hear that term, they think of money, but I think resource allocation is time, it's attention, right? These are all things that are finite, and figuring out where you're going to be, placing your bets, right? So where are you going to put money? Where are you going to have, where's the team going to be spending their time in terms of which customers, which products to build, et cetera? These are all things that are often in short supply. As somebody who's trying to help lead the organization, if I start allocating those resources to the wrong endeavors, it ends up putting us in, ends up forcing us in the wrong direction. And so that's something I'm spending a lot of time with, trying to think of, you know, what are, on the product side, you know, what are incremental versus game changers? And so making sure that we're only focused on building capabilities that we think of as game changers versus those that are just sort of nice to have.
You know, that's some great advice. Now, you know, in the marketplace, agility is key today, whether you're a startup or launching a new product or service within a larger enterprise. And in fact, I've written a number of articles about this, sort of the startup mentality and or creating innovation colonies within larger organizations. So what are some of the key steps for successful startups or for enterprises when producing innovations to keep them competitive?
Yeah, I mean, I think with big companies, there's two parts of, I think, developing a product or a technology or a service, and sort of the nail it, and then there's the scale it part, right? And I think, like, fundamentally, I think big companies have to realize, like, they're not necessarily good at the nail it part, right? Like, big companies often build what they're able to build, not what the market wants them to build. And I think this is hard medicine for a lot of big companies that, like, think of themselves as, like, you know, agile and being able to innovate. Like, the reality is, if you're this, you know, multi-thousand person organization that has this big balance sheet and this big income statement that they need to protect and deliver earnings to the street, the types of people who are very good at that are not always the same types of people who are good at exploring new opportunities and sort of nailing a value proposition and seeing what customers want. And so I think when I look at big corporations, it's really how do you play to your strengths? And their strengths are in scaling and distribution and marketing and other things. So how do you work well with startups to bring things to market that will make you more competitive? And how do you track industries and emerging things that are happening that could be disruptive to your business, and having sort of that open mindset. So I think it's easy for big companies to dismiss startups. We talked about it earlier. You know, they're these little toys, and they do these small little use cases, or they target a customer that's not interesting to us. But the reality is, like, they're going to go up market, and they're going to come after you at some point. So I think, you know, a big challenge for corporations, besides sort of the structural ones around incentives and do we have the right talent, is really just the mindset one. Am I really open to these things, or am I going to talk about all the reasons I'm better than startups, right? Because we hear that a lot, right? Hey, we have a bigger balance sheet. We understand risk management better. We have a better brand, you know, all these things. But, like, those are not those are not etched in stone, right? Like, a lot of companies have had those things and have failed. So kind of the hubris of thinking that that's never going to change is one that I think is something that corporations have to be mindful of.
Yeah, and I guess there's so many recent examples too, right, with the innovation of the smartphone, and so many companies got caught short. And it happened so quickly, and I guess everybody's somewhat afraid, I would say, more so than, let's say, 10 years ago. They realized that, you know, literally within a year or two, they could be out of business. And I think it's going to continue to go that way. And I guess CB Insights is useful. It's a useful tool to for people to look at what's on the, you know, what's coming up and have a look at it and examine it. Now, you have a situation of agility within larger enterprises, and as you indicated, it could be difficult for them. You also have individuals and teams within companies or even within startups. What are some of the key attributes that makes for successful individuals and teams in creating winning products and services?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I think as a startup, it's are you listening to customers, right? And I think that's a bit of it's a little bit of a trite response. So if I unpack that, you know, I think there's explicit feedback that customers give you, and then there's sort of the implicit feedback that they give you when they ask questions or when they're using your product. And so are you learning from that and building solutions that sort of help solve those problems, I think is really important, right? And like talking to customers about those pain points versus trying to cook up something in your head that you think they want. You know, I think that's really important. You know, as an organization gets bigger, how do you make sure that they stay close to the customer, right? So how do you make sure that your engineers are not three steps removed from the customer and the customer actually talking about their pain? Because, you know, if that goes through lots of different layers, it tends to lose a little bit in translation each time. So I think as teams get big or as organizations get big, you know, making sure that staying focused on the customer is really, really important. I think, you know, for us, we were bootstrapped, and we like to use the term revenue funded. And so, you know, customers were our investors, right? We didn't have the luxury of a lot of money in the bank, except unless we made stuff that customers wanted. I think that's been, for us, it's been sort of fundamental, and hopefully, you know, kind of we'd like to believe it's in our DNA. But I think that's really important to kind of have access to and contact and conversations with customers, and ensuring those conversations are happening across different parts of the organization. It's not just, you know, the founders, but it's hopefully the engineers and biz dev and customer success, a bunch of different folks talking to them, and collectively end up getting, I think, a really good perspective on what customers want as a result.
You know, those are some great tips in terms of creating success. I know that you've done a lot of analysis of startups that have failed, and can you talk about that more, some of the attributes of failing startups?
Yeah, so, you know, we analyzed, I think it was like 150 postmortems written by founders. So these are, you know, with the beautiful thing about the tech community is that there's people who are willing to share their wins, but then there's also a smaller group that thankfully is also willing to share when things don't go well. You know, I think there's people who will ascribe their failures in a startup to things that they did, and then there's some who blame the market, right? And so the ones that blame the market, like, I, you know, that's unfortunate, but, you know, that's a separate category. I think when we surveyed all these postmortems, you know, interestingly, the number one reason that people cited was we built something the market didn't want, right? So, again, it was people building something that was a pain point they had, but they never went out and validated that it was a pain point that other people had, you know, or, which I think was one of the other top reasons, was maybe it was a pain point other people had, but it wasn't a big enough one that they were willing to pay for it, right? And so, again, back to like the Cosmo kind of topic we talked about earlier, you know, there's certain laws of economics, and so at some point you need to be making some money. And so if you solve a trivial pain point or something that's a nice to have, you know, unless you're going to be at some massive consumer scale where you can put advertising on it, it's pretty hard to survive unless there's a clear revenue model. So, you know, but yeah, the interesting one that we came, that we saw when we served, when we went through all these postmortems, just founders acknowledging they built something that people didn't want.
Now, you have many interests. Do you want to talk further about them?
Yeah, I mean, I'm pretty dialed into CVI. So CVI is obviously like one of my core ones. You know, I, beyond that, you know, have a fortunate to have a great family. So I have, you know, my wife and two kids. So, you know, a 6-year-old and a 6-month-old. So trying to make sure I'm maintaining some balance between work and seeing them kind of get older. You know, I try to run, not as much as I used to, but try to do that as well. So, yeah, I mean, I think that's been a big part of it. You know, I'd say, like, when it comes to work, you know, it's a big area of what I'm focused on. You know, I think we have a $1 billion opportunity in front of us, so I'm pretty maniacal about that. I always tell the team that, you know, you can debate whether we're the smartest team in the space, but the thing that you will never be able to debate is that we're the hardest working. And so we will outwork everybody. And so, so yeah, I probably had more interest a few years ago, to be honest, but I'd say between family and CB Insights right now, that's pretty much all I'm focused on. And then, you know, if I can get a run in occasionally to clear my brain, that's probably the extent of it, or see some friends on occasion. But yeah, it's probably not as interesting as maybe I would have thought it would have been 5 years ago. But yeah, you know, gotta stay focused. So,
you know, and you're at the top of the game right now, and sort of a global expert in high demand, which means you do a lot of speaking and traveling, a lot of focused on CV Insights that you indicated. Do you have any sort of interesting stories to share? Maybe something amazing or amusing, surprising, or unexpected?
Yeah, I mean, I think I was, before Cosmo, this is an older story, but I was working at a chemical manufacturing firm in India, and we had a disturbance where we weren't able to manufacture a product, and so I had to go to China pretty suddenly to go source this product. And so I went to China, knew nothing about China, obviously, you know, didn't speak the language. And so I was going into really rural parts of China, these manufacturing facilities. And, you know, I think, you know, where nobody really spoke English, and I would jump on these trains, and all I had I wrote down on a piece of paper my destination, and would just show people regularly when a stop would come up, and, you know, just to see if I was getting off in the right place. And, you know, I think it was one of those things, you know, I'm traveling around this country where I can't speak to anybody because I don't speak their native tongue, and nobody speaks English. And, you know, people were still, like, extremely helpful, right? So even with no words being exchanged, like, there was sort of an inherent, like, willingness to help somebody out who clearly, on my, you know, from my perspective, I was clueless. So I think that was one of those things that, like, I look back on. I was there for, you know, a few months, and it was, like, one of the, you know, it was sort of scary in the beginning getting on this train. I was 23 years old and didn't really know what I was doing. And, you know, I think that was one of the things that I kind of remember pretty fondly about that experience. You know, the other things are a little, when we were in London for Cosmo, you know, we were all living together. It was 5 of us living together in an apartment that also served as our office. And so just I remember stories of us trying to make sure that other tenants didn't know that we were running a business out of this apartment. And so all of the things that we had to go, the lengths we had to go through to pretend that we were just residents and not working out of this office as well. So, you know, kind of funny stories from sort of the early startup days that I think cracked me up. And, you know, now I'm not doing a ton of speaking, but when I do go out, you know, I'm fortunate to get to meet a lot of really interesting people pretty regularly and have interesting conversations like this about what's happening in technology and in the investment world. So I count myself pretty fortunate to be able to do that as my job.
Well, and then you're doing an amazing piece of work, and you're contributing to the global landscape, and you're becoming a part of history because of all the contributions you and your team are making. So I know your schedule is demanding, and we're really fortunate that you came in today to do this interview. And thank you for sharing so much of your deep experiences with our audience.
All right. Thanks, Stephen. Thanks so much for your time.
I'm Stephen Ibaraki, and this concludes our exclusive interview with Anand Sanwal.